You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tolstoy wrote that happy families are all alike, but surely that can't be true if those families have children. Would those happy children be raised according to the tenets of Dr. Spock or B.F. Skinner in the French style with the plenty of benign neglect, or by Chinese tiger moms who use sticks instead of carrots? Bruce Feiler's latest book, The Secrets of Happy Families, claims to have cracked the code by looking outside the box for advice. He looks to Warren Buffett on issues like allowances and to Harvard University for conflict resolutions. And finally, as many of us have only wished to do, he called in the Green Berets. His book is published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Bruce Feiler back to our show. Hello.
Great to be with you, Lenny. I'm chuckling just the introduction alone.
Your previous books, like Learning to Bow, Walking the Bible, Looking for Class, Council of Dads, have been about seeking something. Has the culture of your family been shaped by those works?
It has. And I think that one of the things that I've learned over time is that there are new ideas out there, but they don't always come to you. I mean, let me just say at the outset that I set out on this project, on this seeking, not because I had a family, but because I wanted one, because we were just overwhelmed with the chaos around the house. My daughters are now almost eight, and getting out the door, you know, getting them to bed at night, dealing with discipline, self-motivation, we just were at a loss. And it just seemed to me that the family improvement space, if we have this, parents have this straitjacket that the only things we're allowed to try at home must come pre-approved from sort of shrinks and self-help gurus and other experts.
Well, there are a lot of books out there. But you found Dr. Spock wanting and T. Barry Brazelton?
Yeah, I feel like if one more person tells me to listen closely to my child and repeat back what they say and, you know, honor, it's just like the same things over and over again. And yet we know that in every other arena of life, from Silicon Valley to corporate America to, you mentioned, the military, there's been a tremendous amount of research about what makes groups and teams work effectively. I wanted to know what folks in those world were doing with their kids. And my wife basically set one goal. I don't want theory. I want to know that real families are doing it, and I'm prepared to try.
So you didn't even try to Ferberize your kids?
One of the things is this, you know, our kids were through that phase, through the diapers and the sippy cups and all that. We were kind of at that. There's a kind of this moment where about a 10-year period, first step to the first kiss, maybe, you know, from potty training to the prom, where you can imprint a family culture. So we were through that stuff. We were now into an area where there's just actually not a lot.
Well, do you think that the institution of family has changed in recent decades?
You know, here's the
since you grew up, and since your parents tried all those theories on you.
Exactly. I mean, yes. Here's the good news. The good news is we've seen tremendous changes. Blended families, adoptive families, nuclear families that live in the same house, and divorce families. Nuclear families in separate houses and divorce families who nest is the term, right, in the same house. But actually, family has grown stronger. 8 in 10 people say the family they have today is as strong or stronger than the one they grew up in. The problem is we're out of control. Ellen Galinsky of the Families and Work Institute asked 1,000 children, if you could change one thing about your parents, if you could be granted one wish, what would it be? The parents, Lenny, all predicted that the kids would say spending more time with them. They were wrong. The kids' number one wish, that their parents be less tired and less stressed. We have to change this dynamic. The family experts have had their say. We need some new ideas.
So the kids are aware of when we're stressed.
That's the thing. They are on to us. They know that we don't know what they're doing. And the issue is, to me, it's the rapid pace of change, right? So just when they stop teething, they start tantrums. Just when they stop needing our help taking a bath, they need our help dealing with online bullying. So you need a system, which is kind of what I stumbled upon, to have adaptability and yet do it in a controlled way that doesn't drive you crazy.
So just when you've gotten good at one thing, like changing diapers or arranging play dates or dealing with tantrums, the kids have moved on to another phase, and
yes,
you got to learn all over again.
My favorite line of parenting comes from my friend Justin, who had 4 kids in 6 years, and he's like, with parenting, everything is a phase, even the good parts. So even when it's good, and that's why I ended up, and you know, my book, as you know, begins with this idea that grows out of Silicon Valley, which is an idea called agile development, which is sweeping in software design and now in management suites. And the idea is you need to adapt all the time, have daily review sessions is what they do in business, or weekly kind of updates. And a lot of parents have started doing this in their home, and we've basically implemented a similar system in our lives.
Well, can you give us an example of how agile organization can be applied to the home? I understand how it works at Google.
Yes, exactly. Well, we now have a weekly meeting.
Does that mean I have to throw spitballs like the guys at Google do?
Foosball. You really need a foosball table. You know, that's actually it's a key to happiness. We now have a weekly family meeting where we basically ask three questions that grew out of this idea, right? What worked well in our family this week? What didn't work well, and what will we work on in the coming week? And we pick on two. And this week in our family, it's overreacting. My girls are 8 and trying to get to bed with reduced parental yelling. And here's the key. The key is we let our kids pick their own rewards and punishments. Research shows if children plan their own schedules, make their own work plans, evaluate their own work, they build up their prefrontal cortex and take greater control over their lives. And so it's not top. Nothing is top down. Politics, media, government, nothing is top down. Business, we need to enlist our children, basically give them practice performing the skills we want them to perform.
But won't they take advantage? After all, a kid is pretty much all id.
It's the opposite, actually. And I've looked at a lot of families who do this. Our kids are little Stalins. They are much stricter than we would be. And if anything, we're constantly dialing them back. I mean, so this week we're working on overreacting, and one said, well, you get 5 minutes a week. And the sister said, is that 1 5-minute overreaction or 10 30-second overreactions? So to me, that's success right there. We're getting them thinking, because the real test of parenting is when the parents aren't there. Sure, we can force our will on them, but we want them to do it when we're not around.
My guest is Bruce Feiler, whose latest book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. So let's talk about those mornings. Many parents find them unbearable, just getting the kids up and out the door. How would you suggest applying the Agile system to that predictable and recurring problem?
We create a morning checklist. A key plank of Agile is information radiators, large boards where everyone's accountable to everybody else. So we have a morning checklist with the things we want our girls to do, which we've designed together, and every few months we update it.
The kids help develop the morning
checklist. The kids help develop it, and here's the key. Again, they are responsible for checking it off. And it's remarkable how honest they can be. And the point is, okay, the week we implemented this system, we cut parental yelling in half. And by the way, that's my metric. You know, if I can yell less and we can get out the door on time, everybody's happier. By the way, most especially them. The point is, you know, the buzzword, my wife works in entrepreneurship, as you may remember. And in that world, it's all about co-creation. Okay, we're not enforcing it. We are literally co-creating this family together.
And you believe in letting your children pick their own punishment. Haven't you read them Peter Rabbit? When Peter gets caught by the farmer, he begs, please, Mr. McGregor, don't throw me into that briar patch, which just happens to be his home.
Well,
the kid is picking, I mean, at least Peter is picking the thing he really wants.
Maybe I'll keep that out of the. I think they may be through the Brer Rabbit phase, and we're approaching Little Women.
Do they come up with questionable punishments?
No, it's interesting. So let's talk about the overreaction. Remember, I said the reward for 5 minutes or fewer of overreacting this week was a sleepover. The punishment for more than 15 minutes of overreaction that they came up with, Lenny, was one push-up for every minute above 15. I would never have come up with this. Is the point? Like, I might have picked ice cream. I might have picked, you don't get your 1 hour of screen time on the weekend. But they are picking things that motivate them. That's the point. You know, a lot of parents, we feel like our kids are Bermuda triangles. Like, our thoughts come in, but they never come out. We don't know what they're thinking. This has given us access into their innermost thoughts, and it's helping make them more intrinsically motivated.
Well, I wonder whether it would be different if you had two boys. You have two daughters.
I've looked at a lot of families. In fact, the family that I profile in my book, as you know, they started it when their kids were young. They now have from 10 to 15. One has Asperger's syndrome. One has ADHD. One tutors math on the far side. One plays lacrosse on the near side. They actually said to me they think this works better as kids get older because the lives get even more complicated, and this allows everybody to be for 20 minutes a week. It doesn't take that long to be on the same page. And here's the big picture, Lenny. We have our jobs. We work on those. We have our hobbies. We work on those. We have our bodies. We work on those. Research clearly shows that what have we learned from positive psychology? Our families are central to our overall being. Happiness is other people. This is the key relationship in our lives, and we simply are not working on
it. And many people have talked about how important having a family dinner is. But can't that be a real problem, just the inconvenience of getting the food and everyone in the family to the table at the same time? And then you have the problem of a kid deciding she doesn't like broccoli, or she's not going to eat meat anymore, or whatever it is that...
Have you been to our house for dinner when I wasn't there? You've named all the
I've been to other houses to dinner. I've been to my, I was one of four kids.
Look, here, I love this. This is like one of my great finds. If we've heard anything, it's family dinner is important, but it just simply doesn't work in a lot of families, mine included. My wife doesn't even come home from work until 6:30, and the girls need to be fed much earlier. Dig deeper into the research. It's much relieving for parents. It turns out there's only 10 minutes of meaningful conversation in every meal. Family meals have been, thousands of them have been logged. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup. You can take that 10 minutes, move it to any time of the day. Have family breakfast. Have a bedtime snack. Even one meal on the weekends has the same benefit. We time shift our work. We now time shift our TV, as we know, with DVRs. You can time shift family dinner, still have the benefits.
Well, I have a feeling that the whole idea of the family dinner tying everybody together comes from European traditions.
Some of them in the middle of the afternoon, as we know.
But things are a little different today, partly because of all the new technologies. And unfortunately, we see adults at dinner looking at their cell phones,
yes,
checking
exactly.
out their email.
And here's the thing. You know, the family dinner thing, it's like what you talk about turns out to be much more important. I mean, we test drove about two dozen of these family dinner activities and came up with a handful that work. I mean, here's a simple one, which is your kids need to learn 3,000 words a year. You can help by teaching your kid a new word every day or every time you sit together.
Make it into a game?
Make it into a game. Bring a newspaper, bring a magazine, a catalog. I mean, catalog, colors and catalogs. Bring a catalog to the table or a magazine. Find a word you don't know and teach it to your kid. And when we started doing this recently, it turns out our girls know all these words, kind of slang things that we never heard. So they're teaching us words. Suddenly you're having a conversation. It's productive and it's actually advancing a skill that they need to be developing.
How important is it that children become familiar with their family history?
This is my single favorite piece of advice in the entire book. Researchers at Emory gave kids a simple do you know test. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Do you know where your parents went to high school? Do you know someone in your family who had an illness or something else bad that happened to them? Kids who scored higher on this do you know test had a higher self-esteem and confidence. It was the single biggest predictor of emotional health and well-being. Why? Because they understand they're part of a long narrative, these kids. Tell them about your family's positive moments. The negative ones, how their relatives overcame them, it'll give them the confidence. When they faced inevitable hurdles, it'll give them the confidence to push through them.
We are inviting our listeners to join in the conversation in the second part of this discussion with Bruce Feiler.
Excellent.
You can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, tweet at our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You can go to Facebook and connect to us there. If you have any thoughts about what makes families happier, you might give us a call. You might have suggestions. You might have worries about it. You might have the sorts of things that people write to Bruce Feiler about when he writes his column on contemporary family life in the New York Times. He's the author of 5 consecutive New York Times bestsellers, including Walking the Bible and The Council of Dads. His latest, the one we're discussing, is The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. It is published by William Morrow. And we'll be back with you and more Bruce Feiler after we take a little break. Again, the number 212-433-9692. We're back with Bruce Feiler, who has written a book called The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. It is published by William Morrow. You could write a book called The Secrets of Writing Bestsellers. How many bestsellers have you written so far?
I've had five in a row. This is in the top 10 of Amazon as we speak. Went through five printings on its publication day, which was yesterday, I'm thrilled to say. So, you know, families need some new ideas, and so I'm very pleased.
A listener, Karen from Northport, wanted to know if there's any research about parents who help their kids with their homework. Are there any benefits or drawbacks?
It's an interesting, delicate balance that we've been talking about here all morning between wanting to help your kid do a good job, but at the same time wanting to help make them be more independent. I wrote a column, you were mentioning my New York Times column on families. I wrote one last year called Don't Worry About the Bake Sale that created a little bit of a stir. And the chief finding that I walked away with was worry less about stressing out about are you volunteering enough at school and worry more about monitoring homework at home. Schools need a lot of help, and if you have time to volunteer, that's fantastic. But what the teachers say is let us deal with the hallways at the school. You deal with the hallways at home. So, yeah, they really want you to be paying attention and to get back to co-creation, be a co-creator with the school and monitor what they're doing at home.
But what happens if your kid is just totally stymied by homework? How involved do you get? I remember in junior high, I had a teacher who said, "Tell your father he got an A on this."
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, you clearly want to do it themselves, and that's the larger message here. I'm saying repeatedly, if you're doing it and your child is struggling, you need to be letting the teacher know that the child is struggling, not pretending that the child is not struggling. What the teachers say that they want is they want to see in the homework where the child is, so they can help the child if that's what the child needs.
We'll take a call from Ella from Manhattan. Hi, Ella. You're on the air. Oh, no. She's from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi. Hi there. My question relates to how this advice translates into families that are in the process of separating or single-parent households.
It's interesting that you asked that question. It's been coming up a lot as I've been talking about this book. And, you know, here's what I gather here. And here's, I think, the best answer that I can give you. What we're talking about here is having a conversation with your children about how you are running as a family. Literally saying, let's talk about it. And every week, making changes in real time. So especially when there are two different households, maybe the mom household has one set of rules, maybe the dad household has a different set of rules, maybe one of those parents is getting into another relationship. You clearly cannot control what's going on in the other house, but you can say, when you're here, we have to come up together with a way of making this work. So I actually think the odd advantage that you have in a situation of separation or divorce or remarriage or blended families or whatever it may be is that you are forced to get these ideas onto the table. You know, one of the reasons that families have conflict, one of the reasons siblings have conflicts, couples have conflicts, parents and children, is they take the relationship for granted. And you can sweep these things under the rug at work. You can't at home. You have to bring it out because you know that you're actually one step ahead.
But there are other problems when you consult with your kids and the kids think that they have real input, and then you are forced at some time or other to say, you're going to do this because I'm the parent and I know best. And then suddenly I've had this actually in job situations where bosses have gotten a whole staff together and they've asked for our ideas, our input, and then nothing ever happened. So we just felt it was a waste of time. In the end, the boss wound up doing what the parent does and saying what I say goes.
There is a tremendous amount of research in the workplace, and increasingly we're now seeing it in the family, that top-down leadership is not the most effective leadership. Sometimes you need it. I'm not saying let the kids run the asylum. You know, sometimes you got to say, we got to get on that plane or we're going to miss it. Or I need you to be quiet because I got to talk to this doctor on the phone.
Or I don't want you to see this kid who is really destructive.
Exactly. Or there's some pattern that you're engaging in and we need to get professional help in some way. But the most effective teams have input from multiple directions. It's not all bottom up, but it's also not all top down. And what I'm talking about in this family meeting structure that a lot of families are adopting that we have found great success in is it creates this safe zone where you can have these conversations. There's still parental guidance, but if you can force your kids into it, but it will come to a point when they will tune you out.
Lucy from Manhattan writes, What do you do when the one who needs the discipline is your 38-year-old co-parent?
Yeah, well, hello. This is a problem that I have. With my wife and I have very different parenting techniques. You know, one of the things that you hear a lot is make sure you can pick whatever style you want, but make sure that you're consistent in that style.
And when parents fight in front of the kids over what to do when some problem arises, that just causes – well, the kids also understand divide and conquer, don't they?
Well, here's a very interesting thing. Actually, I love this study that I saw, that actually fighting in front of your kids is only destructive if you only fight in front of them. If you actually reconcile in front of them, you're actually giving them the skills. I mean, I went, as you know, to the Harvard Negotiation Project. These people deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and Northern Irish and Irish talks and general strikes. And we have implemented a kind of watered-down version of the system in our house. And that is, first of all, separate. In negotiation speak, it's go to the balcony, take a break. Anybody can call for a five-minute break at any time. You look back on the stage from the balcony and calm down. Then come up with alternatives, and that's the key. So if you're fighting over fuzzy socks of your kids, or if you're fighting over, you know, some larger problem as a parent, everyone comes up with alternatives. At that point, there's six or seven on the table. It tends out to be not all that complicated to pick one or two that everybody can agree on.
They have a five-step process?
They have a larger process, and we've kind of watered it down to three with our kids. But one of the things that we've done, actually, and one of the things I learned about fighting, is it matters when. 6 to 8 is the highest stress time in any family. We were fighting at 7:42 p.m. every night with my wife and I about who's dropping off the dry cleaning, right? Who's going to pick up the shin guards? We now moved it till after everyone's had a chance to change clothes and have a bite to eat. We've also changed where we sit. There's this amazing body of research that the psychologist introduced me to, that if you're sitting at a hard chair in front of a rigid table, you're going to be more rigid. If you're sitting on a cushion chair, you're going to be more open-minded. She said when you discipline your kids, sit on a cushioned surface. And my wife
Go into the living room.
Yeah, or in fact, what we do in the living room, my wife and I, because we're at the same level, because we were always arguing. I was at my desk, got a big computer, it's high up, it's got all the power. She was lower on this old IKEA chair and resentful. So we've changed. And when we have really difficult conversations, we move to this window bench because we're sitting side by side, because research shows you'll be collaborative. I mean, the big point here, Lenny, I see you're about to ask another question, is the big point here is let the best ideas win. We don't just need ideas from this family improvement space. There's a lot of ideas. One of the reasons I put 200 ideas in this book was because it was very obvious you couldn't do all of them. So you pick three that are most relevant to you, you'll have a happier family.
And one kid needs a different approach than the next kid. No two children are the same.
That's exactly right. And if you actually spend, if you want to reduce sibling conflict and reduce conflict between parents and children, if you spend 10 minutes a day with each child, letting them dictate what you're going to do, you will make that bond. And put the siblings together doing a task before a meal or a long car ride, that'll build up their confidence so they will squabble less.
What do you mean when you say that pronouns are the canary in the coal mine of conflict?
There's a fascinating body of research. This is actually particularly up your alley. I's are good, actually. I feel this. I feel that. We's are particularly good because it shows very good we-ness in the academic terms. You is the biggest single predictor of a problem. You know, I don't know about your mother. I mean, I can't decide which is worse. You do this or you always do that, or your mother. You know, somehow bringing your mother in may be worse. But if you want to stop fighting, stop saying you. That's a great simple tip that you can put in place tonight.
Does allowance teach children anything constructive?
It's interesting. I looked at this very deeply. There's actually not a lot of studies about children.
Because people sometimes are worried that you spoil a kid by giving him or her money.
Yeah. I looked at the research, and there's a lot of research that the more kids are looking at money, the more they are becoming selfish, actually, and less cooperative. We have chores in our family after all this research of mine, and we have allowance. We don't link the two. Sorry, the bed's got to get made. You got to do it. The table's got to set. Someone's got to empty the trash, and you got to do it on your share. Here's the best single thing I learned about allowance. I talked to Warren Buffett's banker because I thought wealthy families would be better, and he actually told me that it's wrong. And this is the best piece of advice he gave me. We give our kids $1 per year, and we divide it into four pots: save, spend, give away, and share. And we would force them to put it in equal measure. And he said, don't do that. Let them make their own mistakes. And I said, well, what if they drive into a ditch? This is one of my five favorite lines in the whole book. He said, it's much better to drive into a ditch with a $6 allowance than a $60,000 a year salary or a $6 million inheritance. And it's part of this larger message. Let your kids make their mistakes now when it's not so costly, because 80% of kids get to college and have never had a conversation about debt. Then they get credit cards. Then they're in trouble.
What about when the kids fight, which is normal?
Yes.
Is there any way a parent can manage the sibling relationship without becoming a cop or a referee?
You really don't want to be a referee. Our system, as I said, separate them, come up with alternatives, bring them back together. But here's the larger point that I would make. The research clearly shows spend less time worrying about the bad problems around the house, spend more time building up the good. All families have conflict. You want to control it and isolate it as quick as you can. But the best thing you can do for the conflict is actually make a positive memory, because the positive experiences, the value of play, doing things together, that will actually outweigh the negative.
Talking about conflict, what did you learn from the Green Berets?
This was great. You know, we would have these family reunions in the summer. My extended family in Georgia, my wife's in Boston, and the separate families would retreat to separate corners. 100 million Americans actually go to a family reunion every year. And we weren't taking advantage. And I thought, who brings people together better than the Green Berets? And so I worked with these guys and looked at the unit cohesion research from the military. First of all, make teams. Nothing builds an us better than a them. Have people of different generations. Like the old camp color war system, if you have teams, can have cheers, they can have chants or team names. Could be a family trivia contest, could be sports. It doesn't matter. It brings people together, and again, has that bonding experience. So when the inevitable conflicts arise, you have the foundation that you can build off of.
You mentioned sports reminds me of many soccer games I've attended and watched parents go bonkers.
Yes.
And I've wondered what kind of a role model they are in this case. What are they teaching their kids? But why do you think parents are so often bad sports?
It's really, I have the research in this book. It is really startling. I mean, it's like 15% of games end up with parents in fights, either with one another or with the refs. That's really, my kids are now youth soccer players in Brooklyn, or with the players themselves. I talked to the guys from Positive Coaching. I actually got an email from them as I was walking into the studio. They had some great tips. One of them was no PGA. No post-game analysis. You're not a shock jock. Don't dissect the game. Let the coach, you be supportive. And my favorite advice about for parents, and by the way, I have to say I'm not that great at this, is no verbs. So you can say in a game, good shot. You can, nice pass, way to pay attention, but not shoot, pass, you're open, score. So no verbs. I'm telling you, you're a sports parent. Try to implement that rule. It's really hard.
Now I come to the subject I'm most uncomfortable talking about, because the FCC has all sorts of rules. But is it necessary to have a sex talk with your kids?
In fact, ditch the sex talk. There's
no birds and bees.
No birds and bees. If you wait till a certain age and say it's the talk, you're in trouble, because most of us wait till our kids are too old, at which point they tune us out. I met these girls in Connecticut on a swim team, and we were talking about this, and they were like, it's not a talk. It's a series of talks. It's a conversation. The American Pediatrics Academy says as early as 18 months. I mean, I assume this is legal. You can get the buzzer. You can get the tape delay ready for me. When I read the kids, boys and girls, know that boys have penises and girls have down there, I thought, you know what? I'm making that mistake with my kids. I am not – use proper words. Use proper names. What the girl said to me was, when our parents talked to us about sex, we stuck our fingers in our ear. And then we pull them halfway out, because we're pretending we don't want to hear, but there's so much misinformation on the internet. Use proper words. Explain to your kids what they're hearing, because they're too embarrassed in front of their friends. And do it starting when they're young.
You write about what you call a sex mom?
Yeah. I mean, she
what were her techniques for sex?
Her techniques were, first of all, to have these conversations with the friends. And when she would do it, and this is, I love this tip, she would do it in cars. She'd be driving carpool and they were trapped. And by the way, there is research that difficult conversations with teenagers go better if you're not looking at them in the eye. If you're driving in a car or folding the laundry or loading the dishwasher, it's somehow easier, because you're not saying to your kid, this is a really important conversation. You're actually doing it subtly. She would give her daughters, when they would reach their when they have their first, look at me, I'm stumbling even on the show. I can't even use the language. When they'd have their first menstruation, she'd have a little packet. She would give them, you know, some chocolate, a Helen Reddy, I Am Woman, I Am Woman CD. And instead of complaining, the other
moms. She's being a role model giving the kid that terrible recording.
Okay, I finally offended Lenny Lope with a bad 1970s music reference. I'm delighted. The other parents, instead of being upset, sent their kids to her and said, you know what? And by the way, this is you talk about divorced parents. You know, you can't wait for the other parent to do it. You need to do it yourself before they tune. It's much easier when they're younger before they tune you out.
Well, it's important for you to be the one who gives the kid the advice rather than the kids at school. Because you're going to give them better. You're going to give them better information. At least we hope you are.
You're going to give them accurate information. That's really the key. And they're not going to be embarrassed to say, "I don't really know what you're talking about." By the way, and this is one of my, you know, the kind of the big themes I ended up with. You know, talking about Tolstoy at the beginning of this conversation. Adapt all the time. Talk a lot. Have these conversations. It's an ongoing conversation. And then the third is, go out and play.
Well, of course, Tolstoy was wrong when he said all happy families are alike.
I disagree. I think he was right, actually.
You do?
I, for most of my life, I thought that he was wrong. I thought that line was inane. Of course, all happy families, some are big, some are small, some are boisterous, some are quiet. For the first time ever, in the last 10 years or so, Lenny, we have this research, and I think it does allow us to say they have certain broad themes in common. So I think Tolstoy was right.
So you're saying we should look to all these other places, the way businesses are run, the way, I mentioned the Green Beret,
yes.
the way conflict resolution is handled at Harvard, have a family mission statement.
What the corporations do. We created a family mission statement. Here's an analogy, Mr. Music Lover, that you will like. Okay, you turn on a radio station, or you go into the record store back when they had record stores. Everything was divided. There's the country station, there's the rock, the oldies, the hip hop. You go into anybody's home on their record collection, they're going to have a mix. They're going to have from different sections of the store and different radios on the and different channels on the dial.
Sometimes they're even going to fight when you're in the car and you want to play one station and somebody else wants to play another station.
It's the same with our bookshelves. It's the same with our pantries of the food. We have things from different countries. Why is it that the only ideas from families have to come from the family space? It's not how we live in any other aspect of our lives. And what's happening now is, for the first time, a new generation of parents is saying, I've had enough. I want new ideas. So I'm not saying take them from business. What I'm saying is this is going on out there. I have reported on it for the last 3 years and give you some new ideas. You ain't going to like all of them. No way. But I'm telling you, there are ideas in here that will help every family.
So try them, see which ones work, which ones don't.
That, to me, is the big lesson. The most quoted line to me in this book, now that it's gone on sale, is the last one. You don't need a big plan. You don't need a master scheme. Take small steps. Accumulate small wins. What's the secret to a happy family? Try.
Bruce Feiler will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on East 86th Street. His book, The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. It's published by William Morrow. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Lenny. You're such a great host. It's great to be with you.